Welcome to the Times of Israel's daily briefing. Today is Monday, April 1st, day 178 of the war with Hamas. Amanda Borchel Dan here with our diplomatic reporter, Lazer Berman. Hi, Lazer. Thanks for joining me today from our Jerusalem offices.
Hi, Amanda. Good morning.
Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu held a surprise press conference last night, and we'll hear what he had to say. Lazer will also brief us on the resumption of hostage release talks after they appeared on hold last week. Israel has responded harshly to two UN-backed reports, one on the aid organization UNRWA and the other on the levels of famine in Gaza. All this and much, much more when we're back.
The Technion Israel Institute of Technology is where some of Israel's brightest minds ask the biggest question of all. What if? What if they could take on the world's biggest challenges? What if they could develop life-changing environmental, scientific, health, medical, and technological discoveries that will make a huge impact on Israel and the planet? But they don't just ask the question, they answer it too. They turn those ideas into reality. They make them happen. To see just some of the incredible things they've achieved, get the Technion Booklet of Wonders at ats.org/wonders. We hope it inspires you to give them your support so they can keep doing what they do best. The American Technion Society. World-changing discoveries by Israel's brightest minds, made possible by you.
First, some headlines. Three people were seriously wounded in a suspected terror knifing at a mall in the southern Israel city of Gan Yavne last night. Two of the victims are undergoing surgery today, and the third, a minor, is in stable condition. The attacker was identified as a 19-year-old Palestinian, and he was shot dead by security officers at the scene. The IDF has confirmed it has wrapped up its operation against Hamas at the Gaza City Shifa Hospital overnight, with all the troops leaving the area. Eyewitnesses who have returned to the scene describe total destruction. A drone apparently launched from Iraq struck a building in Israel's southernmost city of Eilat early this morning. A sister of Hamas leader Ismail Haniyeh has been arrested on suspicion of contact with operatives from the terror group and supporting acts of terror. Last night, tens of thousands of demonstrators packed streets outside the Knesset in Jerusalem in a mass protest demanding the government resign, marking the first in what is slated to be a four-day event. And at the same time, the protesters accused Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu of abandoning hostages in Gaza and mismanaging the war against Hamas. So for his part, in a press conference last night, Netanyahu insisted that he was doing everything in his power to bring the captives home. What else did our prime minister say, Lazer?
So I thought what was notable about the press conference, it was his first in more than a month, was that it was somewhat of a dialogue or an argument between the protesters out in the streets, tens of thousands of protesters demanding that he hold elections, calling for him basically to go over the mismanagement of the war and abandoning the hostages. So he was basically pushing back on that. He said that anyone who says that he is not doing everything he can to bring the hostages home is adding additional agony to the families. I think that was directed at the people outside. He also said that holding elections now would freeze the country for up to 8 months. And that is exactly what Hamas wants. And then you had actually Lapid issue a statement back at Netanyahu after he said that, and saying that it is Netanyahu who's paralyzing the country diplomatically and the war as well. So it was this interesting back and forth indirectly with protesters outside. The interesting part of this, of the press conference, was the last question, where he was clearly speaking with a lot more passion and speaking off the cuff about these protests and about anti-Semitism around the world. And, you know, he talked about conversations where he had with his father about how could people believe that, you know, Jews had poisoned wells in the Middle Ages. And he said that his father said, it's not just ignorance. There's something more malicious at stake here. And he said, that's part of the reason why people believe and say all these things about the IDF and about Israel. I think he's certainly not wrong on that, that, you know, it's not only ignorance that is behind a lot of what we hear on the streets of London or even in the U.S., but there's something really pro-Hamas in some places, and certainly anti-Semitism is a part of that. So that was something where you saw him change from his prepared remarks and really go off much more of an extensive fashion than it would have expected, especially at the end of the press conference. He really could have just ended the press conference, but he chose to go for several minutes on this issue.
He also slightly addressed the issue of the former foreign press, Elon Levy, and his suspension. What did Netanyahu say about that?
So that was something that he didn't want to talk about. Clearly, that was in response to one of the last questions. Elon Levy, we have this article up on our site right now. He rose to stardom as this very eloquent, Oxbridge-educated spokesman. He was a spokesman for President Herzog. And he really, you know, became one of the bright lights of Israeli messaging during the war, of which there's not that many. But then he was suspended a few weeks ago, ostensibly because he tweeted back at David Cameron, the British Foreign Secretary. But I think everyone understands, and he certainly hinted this as well, Levy did, that it was because Sarah Netanyahu didn't like the fact that he was participating in those Kaplan protests before the war. Bibi didn't really speak about that much. He said, I wasn't involved with it, I didn't see it, and then he moved on to other issues. So he certainly didn't want to talk about this much. I thought it was interesting in Levy's interview with the Times of Israel, he said, I didn't talk to Netanyahu at all. Like, we never had any conversations. We didn't sit down to talk about strategy. I think that interview should be read. And as people, I think, feel like there's something not quite optimal about the way the messaging is being conducted during the war, I think you could see some evidence of it here, that it's more ad hoc than it needs to be. It's not clear that there's a real hand or a real direction from above. And I think there's a lot to be learned from that. So I would definitely recommend reading that. But there's no question that Netanyahu was not interested in speaking at length about that. He really moved by it very quickly.
The question of who is the hand above in the hostage release negotiations is also definitely relevant, as according to multiple media reports, truce talks to release the hostages were set to resume yesterday in Cairo. Did they, and who was sent?
Yeah, so this was not... There was a statement a couple days ago where Netanyahu says, I believe it was on Saturday night, and he says that he spoke with the Mossad chief, David Barnea, Shin Bet head, Ronen Bar, and he told them that he approved a delegation under their authority to go to Cairo initially. That doesn't mean that they're going. These are mid-level teams. The point is to try to understand if there's even any reason to send these senior figures to future talks, whether it's in Cairo or in Doha. The fact that it's in Cairo now, I think, is not at all coincidence. An Israeli official told me yesterday that there is really growing frustration with Qatar. There's a sense that they're really not putting the requisite pressure on Hamas to make concessions. We've seen that Hamas is digging into these unreasonable demands, still talking about the end of the war, the withdrawal of IDF troops. And now a big sticking point is this Hamas demand that there's unfettered access or unfettered return of Gazans to northern Gaza. Now, in some ways, that's not such a huge problem for Israel, because Israel's trying right now to get civilians, or will be soon trying to get civilians, to move from the Rafah area so they can start that operation that Israeli leaders have been talking about for weeks now. On the other hand, we can't have Hamas move back into northern Gaza, and obviously Hamas is looking to do that in force. There's still plenty of Hamas individuals, but the fact that they would be able to move in massive numbers would mean they're getting away from the IDF in the south, and they're going to be able to show that they have not been defeated in the north. There's also the issue that Israelis living around the Gaza area have moved back in large numbers to those cities and kibbutzim around the area, and the more you let people move back and Hamas move back, then you're increasing the risk that there is some sort of fire, you know, that could be fired on, and that you're not able to protect them and you brought them back too early. So there's a lot of risk here. And the Israeli feeling is that Qatar is not doing its job as a mediator, and that, you know, Egypt is the one who's going to host these talks now. I think there's certainly more trust with the Egyptians than with the Qataris.
So do you see them moving forward?
For weeks now, I've been saying that there's not a lot of optimism on the Israeli side. I think there's, if you're Sinwar, you know, as hard as it is to get into his head, but let's just look at the strategic picture here. He understands he's been through the worst of the Israeli military offensive, right? He survived that. He survived November, December. He understands that Israel has pulled most of its troops out. He understands the longer he waits, the more there are calls for a ceasefire, like we saw at the UN Security Council, and now that we have France cooking up another resolution. Israel is increasingly isolated. He understands, I would assume, that he's been told that the relationship between the Biden administration and Netanyahu is getting worse. So why should he rush? His position, he feels, will be better in a couple weeks, and it might be better in a month. The only thing I think that will change that trajectory is if there's a real threat to his survival and the survival of his organization. Of course, that will come from that offensive kicking off. So I think we should not be especially optimistic. If there was going to be a deal on the parameters that we've spoken about for a couple of weeks, I think it would have happened. Really, something needs to change, because as of now, every week that goes by, I think it's reasonable for Sinwar to say he's sitting prettier and prettier, and Netanyahu is in a worse and worse position.
Okay, we'll get to a short break.
I got married this Monday in the middle of a war.
You are not a soldier anymore. You are 50 years old. What is the matter with you?
It's like a couple of kilometers from here. Like, my friend has a 4x4. Let's just go cut across the fields and go get him.
Israel Stories, Wartime Diaries. Voices that try to capture slivers of life right now.
And he told me, take with you a sleeping bag and a tent and just go.
I texted him on, like, after I was told that he was killed.
From their eyes, I was a traitor.
Everybody needs their, like, blankie, their teddy bear, something to make them feel safe.
I'm just another grandfather looking after his grandchild while his son is off at war.
These children of Hamas now will be the killer of my children.
I desperately wanted to talk about sex during my eulogy for Ido.
Everyone has to choose to be optimistic, because we don't have room for pessimism.
Check out Israel Story wherever you get your podcasts.
And we're back. On Friday, Israel contested a recent UN-backed report on the humanitarian situation in Gaza that said famine was imminent and likely to occur in May in northern Gaza and by July in other parts of the Strip. The report was written by the Integrated Food Security Phase Classification and has been used by many to heighten global concerns regarding the humanitarian situation in the war-torn Strip. Now, COGAT, the Israeli Defense Ministry body responsible for civilian affairs in the Palestinian territories, said on Friday that, quote, the report contains multiple factual and methodological flaws, some of them serious. To be clear, Israel is not denying that the situation in Gaza is serious. It's just the question of how serious. And Laser, you've been tracking the entrance of trucks for us into the Gaza Strip, food trucks in particular. And what are you seeing yourself, first of all?
So I will be totally open here. I certainly have not been to places where there's, you know, gatherings of Palestinians. That's not an option for Israelis and Israeli journalists. But I have been tracking the numbers. And I think there's some important things to say here that is not being properly reported. There's this number of 500 trucks going in before the war. And that is assumed to mean there was 500 food trucks. And that is not true. Most of those trucks going in daily before the war were commercial materials, especially construction materials. We know what Hamas did with a lot of those. Food trucks was often below 100. And now we're up to some days over 200. So the number of food trucks going in is often higher than it was before the war, with the caveat that Gaza produced food domestically also before the war, which they're really not doing anymore. So there's some balance there. But that's in terms of food going in. There's these claims that Israel is blocking food. I really, you know, I think that really is not backed up by the facts. And there's certainly not, there were some claims about like thousands, or someone said 30,000 trucks lined up in Egypt waiting to go in. It's just ridiculous. Israel is also increasing the access. There was that gate 96 near Be'eri, which is much closer to the northern Gaza Strip, which has been used. Some nights you get about 9-10 trucks, and sometimes they're looted, sometimes they're not. But the real problem is still the distribution, whether it's local gangs kind of taking over the food, whether it's just hungry people looting them, whether it's Hamas taking over the trucks, and whether it's people taking the aid and then reselling it at massive prices. You can see that in some markets. But in general, Israel says the food is there. You can see, in markets, the markets are relatively full, even though the prices are inflated and astronomical. But it seems to be there's a number of factors, and the accusation that Israel is starving Gaza, I think, is bordering on blood libel. At the same time, the situation is certainly not good. And I think this report is talking more about trends. If nothing changes, then by May, we could be in a really bad situation. But you can see that things are changing. You have that U.S. pier that's going to be built. It'll take a while, but that's being built. The airdrops have increased during Ramadan, but they're not especially effective, and they really don't. They only equal a couple of trucks. So the real thing is going to have to be more trucks getting to the northern Gaza Strip, especially if people are heading there. But it's interesting. I was talking to an Israeli official, and he said that we have not captured a single Hamas terrorist who is malnourished, right? So which either shows that the people, that there's not really this food problem, or it shows that Hamas is taking the food and making sure that they get it first. I can't verify that. I haven't looked at all these Hamas prisoners, but I think it's something interesting to keep in mind, and that certainly reflects a lot of Israeli thinking.
The other point of reference in the report that Israel definitely denies is that there's a huge, massive lack of potable drinking water.
Yeah, it is. These numbers are way off. The UN was talking about a liter per person, and Israel's talking about 20 liters per person that's available per day. So this is really wildly different numbers. Israel says you're relying on incomplete information. There's no way you could have this information, and inevitably you're using Hamas figures given their control of the institutions in the Gaza Strip. So there's no agreement there, but it's also a diplomatic issue. Let's not forget. It gets in the way of international support, certainly gets in the way of what the Biden administration is willing to do. The more that goes in and the more that Israel can point at it, I think Israel will be better off diplomatically as well. And also, there's a moral dimension here, even though that, much of Gaza doesn't, many Gazans don't love Israel and don't have any sympathy, for the Jewish state and our success, doesn't mean Israel doesn't have some responsibilities, at least to make sure that, they are getting the food and medicine and water they need. There's arguments over whose ultimate responsibility it is. Israel says it's not an occupying power, it's not our responsibility, but it has to make sure that at least the aid agencies are able to do their work. It's going to be an ongoing issue. It'll also be a football that people that don't like Israel will use to try to beat Israel over the head with it. But it's important that Israel is clear about what is going in and what its policies are. And it doesn't get in the way unnecessarily of getting food and water into the Gaza Strip. And Israel said throughout, especially now, that most of these are Israeli initiatives, and they've been working on, let's say, the Cyprus Maritime Corridor for months now. And I think more Israeli initiatives are better for everyone.
So relatedly to the issue of aid organizations, yesterday Israel also lambasted an interim report that reviewed allegations by Israel against the Palestinian Refugee Agency, UNRWA, of employing at least a dozen workers who took active roles during the October 7th Hamas massacre of some 1,200. Israel has accused the UN as attempting to cover up the body's failures and its ties to terror organizations in order to allow for it to resume receipt of global funding. So how independent, first of all, do you think that this UN-backed report is?
So it's headed by the French foreign minister. She's not a UN official. I think she's probably sympathetic to a lot of UNRWA's work and its role there. But ultimately, it doesn't say anything deep about the organization. It doesn't say, it doesn't call for it to be replaced. It doesn't focus on the educational problems and what it's done to increase hatred of Israel. And Israel says that it's really just cosmetic, and the fact that they're it's not really coming to the root problems, where you have employees of the organization actually taking part in terrorist attacks and hostage taking. Israel would like to see a much stronger stance there. I think Israel is really has no, even though she met with Israeli officials, she met with the foreign ministry director general here too, so Israel cooperated with this, but there's no question that Israel is not happy with the way that it came out, and there's a question, you know, how much Israel is going to cooperate moving forward if it feels that this is only going to be cover for UNRWA to continue its work and to continue the more problematic aspects of its operations in the Gaza Strip after the war. Israel is doing whatever it can to replace UNRWA in terms of humanitarian aid with other UN agencies like the World Food Program and NGOs like the World Central Kitchen, which are not tainted with terror ties.
So it's spring break season pretty much across the world, and Israel's National Security Council said last week that Israel should avoid traveling to Turkey, Morocco, Jordan, and Egypt, including the Sinai Peninsula, which is really a popular destination over Passover, ironically in a way. And in updated travel warnings, it was saying that this could go on for the next several months. So what is seen as the risk in these areas, Laser?
So for Israel, the big spike right now in tourism is going to be Passover, the holiday where a lot of Israelis fly abroad. And then there's also some big events coming up. You have the Eurovision in Malmo, Sweden. You have the Euro 24 soccer championships, and then you have the Paris Olympics. All of those are places where Israelis are expected to fly in large numbers. There's the global jihadist threat in general targeting these big Western events, but also people on the street. Also, these organizations might target Jews and Israelis as well. There's certainly intelligence about that, and also people in the street. You know, Malmo is a place that has not been friendly to Jews, so there's a recommendation, you know, you can go, but just kind of keep your Israeli identity and even your Jewish identity quiet. Don't yell at each other in Hebrew across the street. It's sad that we've reached that situation, but this is nothing new. And then those countries with which we have, in the Arab world, with which we have peace agreements, and also Turkey, certainly the public sentiment, the popular sentiment, is not positive toward Israelis and even Jews right now. And the recommendation is, you know, let's wait until the images coming out of Gaza are beyond us and people are focusing on other things. There are places where you really don't want to, you want to be smart about how much you advertise, you know, who you are in general, but especially now when there's a lot of anger in the Muslim world and in the Arab world about the conduct of the war in Gaza. It's best not to go to these places. And also there was a warning, don't go to countries with which we don't have ties. So remember, there was that Israeli-Russian researcher who was kidnapped in Iraq. Certainly, you know, there's always danger there, but heightened now across the Western world, across the Arab world as well. As the summer starts, as the Passover travel season begins, you know, things are dangerous enough as it is. And I think they wanted Israeli tourists to realize you might feel like you're getting away from the pressure cooker that Israel feels like sometimes, but the world is also under pressure as well. And to be smart, but you can travel if you want to, just be smart and be aware.
Laser, thank you for all of your insights and updates today.
Thank you, Amanda.
Thanks for listening to the Times of Israel's Daily Briefing. Please check out another installment tomorrow. This episode was produced by The Podwaves. If you have any questions or comments about this or any other episode, please drop us an email to podcast@timesofisrael.com. Until tomorrow, shalom.